Hi, this is Ashton Pills, and welcome to Golden Nuggets for Aspiring Coaches. If this is your first time tuning in, I'm glad you were able to make it. This podcast is designed to share the ideas, stories, and advice from coaches of all levels. Stay tuned. Today's guest is Alan Keane. Welcome to the podcast, Coach.
Thank you very much, Coach. It's a pleasure to be on here, and I've enjoyed many of the stuff that you guys have put out on social media. So congratulations for doing such a wonderful job with that one.
No, thank you. Really honored to have you on today. Kind of starting off, what has been your motivation and continues to be your motivation behind coaching?
The motivation is very easy. To answer that one is very easy for me. It's a simple love for the game. You know, from a young kid, when I was a player, a fan first, and then a player, and then worked my way into coaching, you know, the love for the game has not changed. It's grown. It's gotten stronger and deeper, as all relationships do. It's just taken a different course in terms of coaching. And even now, it's taken on a little bit of a different slant as well, because I seem to be doing a lot of mentoring for other coaches in the past couple of years. And I've formalized that process more recently. So it's taken me in different directions, but it's started with a love for the game. And I think if I go a little bit deeper, Ashton, if I go a little bit deeper, someone asked me recently, why do you coach? And I think the easy answer is because I love the game. I think that's the easy one. And when somebody asked me during this lockdown period, during this quarantine period, to really unpick myself and really dig deep down into why I do what I do, I realized, and I think I realized this before, but didn't acknowledge it as clearly, I realized that I coach inherently, if I can say that. My mom never coached. She loved sports. But actually what she did for a lot of her life was help a lot of people. And when I say a lot of people, I'm talking hundreds. And these were people who had problems with alcohol and drugs. And, you know, my mother, having recovered from that process, she went on probably a 30 to 35 year journey of really helping a lot of people and giving a lot to others. And I think that rubbed off on me in my childhood and in my early adulthood. And I've become more aware of it now. And the buzz I get from helping others through coaching, be it players or other coaches, is a very fulfilling fulfilling element for me. And lastly, I just love the journey. I love the progressive. When I say the journey, I know we hear that a lot. We hear a lot about the process and a lot about the journey. But what I mean by that is I find it very progressive. I find it very stimulating, because no matter who you talk to in basketball, player, coach, manager, owner, you learn something new if you listen long enough. You learn things. It's a very progressive domain, a very progressive world, this game of basketball. And I really enjoy that. It's just constantly learning.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We're always learning. We're always learning. Kind of speaking more on your journey, like you just alluded to, where did you get your start in coaching? And, you know, what are some of the stops that you've had in your journey in the past couple of years?
Well, I guess I got my start from, again, I don't want to get too philosophical or dig too deep, but, you know, if I reflect back to when I was a child, I was always the one that organized the games when we played outside. You know, I always, my friends used to make fun of me for inventing games, like just different rules. And when I look back at it now, actually, I was really good at putting constraints in games, and I had no idea what I was doing, you know, and I think it started from there, really. You know, in terms of performance coaching, you know, I'm from Ireland. I was born and raised and bred in Ireland, but I've been living in London for about 12 or 14 years now. And I quickly got involved in the game when I came to England, when I came to London, started doing club basketball, National League. I hung around it so much, and I asked so many questions, and I formed so many connections that I eventually got offered a job as a regional head coach for the London region. And I coached that team in what we call like national championships each year, where you just play against the other regions in the UK. And we were very successful. And we were successful. And I always say this, Ashton, we were successful not because of my coaching ability at that time, You know, if anything, I probably got in their way. I had very talented players who lived in the London region, and many of them are professional players right now. And most of them went off to the States and came through the NCAA system. And quite a few of them are playing pro right now. So I was very lucky to have those players at a young age, under 13 and then under 15 at the regional program. That really kind of opened the door for me to step into the national team. You know, when you coach in these regional championships, these regional finals each year, you get an opportunity to be assessed by national team coaches, performance directors of the governing body, Great Britain Basketball. And I was lucky that I was offered to be an assistant to Andreas Kopoulos. Andreas Kopoulos is a coach from Greece who's been coaching professional here in the UK for a long time. One of the best coaches we have, very successful. I assisted him with the national team under-16s for a few, under-15s and under-16s for about 4 years altogether. And we went off to the European Championships together to play against the best that Europe has to offer. I then got promoted to head coach of that under-16s team and progressively went on to be the head coach of the GB under-18 team and now currently the Great Britain under-20 team as well. And we just compete in the European Championships every summer against the powerhouses of Europe, and we try to survive that process. The journey, Ashton, has very much evolved throughout the years. You know, we can get into that, what my coaching philosophy looks like in a minute, but it evolved through formal learning and informal learning. It actually evolved more from the informal stuff, like just speaking with other coaches, you know, having a conversation, like even yourself, where I know we got on the phone about a month ago and just had a chat about coaching. Like loads of those informal interactions have really helped me on my journey. But I've also gone through a process of formal qualifications. I've taken basketball coaching from an academic standpoint all the way up to a professional doctorate. I've got about 6 months left on my professional doctorate in coaching, which is very much about coaching style, coaching behavior, the value of what we do on a basketball court, and you know how you enhance decision makers and more mostly balanced players on the court and coaches on the court. So it's really been a combination of formal and informal. But the last thing I would say about that journey, Ashton, is I had, when I look back, I gravitated to really good people. You know, I gravitated towards people like Warwick Kahn, Vlad Andruskovic, Mark Bennett. You know, I gravitated towards people like Joe Prunty, who was over here coaching the senior team and has had, you know, X amount of years in the NBA as an assistant and a head coach. I gravitated to people who were far superior than me in this performance basketball world. And even now to this day, like I've spent the past 2 years just getting on calls with random coaches just to find out what it is they're doing and really pick their brains on what they're really good at. And people outside the sports as well, like, you know, in the past 4 months, I urge your listeners to really, you know, research somebody like Stephen Rolnick and Simon Turner, who've been absolutely fantastic in my progress right up to today. So just gravity towards the right people have been very, very helpful and fruitful in my growth and development and journey as a coach.
Without question, love that. Kind of speaking on your coaching philosophy, like we mentioned we were going to get into, you have a unique approach to your team environment where you really empower your players to be key decision makers and, you know, rely on themselves. So could you just go into more detail about how you came up with this approach?
Yeah, I mean, it was a combination really of stepping back, number one, and being honest with myself about what I'm seeing. Asking myself, is there a better way to do stuff? Interactions and conversations with others about, you know, coaching has provoked my thoughts. And some of my studies, like I guess I did a master's in basketball coaching science, and that really got me to unpick certain things about how I was coaching. What is effective coaching? It facilitated me to take a deep dive into the Spanish coaching system, youth development system for coaches and players, the Serbian youth development, Lithuania, what are they doing to help their players and their coaches grow? But, you know, I'll go back to the conversations I was having with other people and then taking a look at myself, like holding the mirror up to myself and saying, well, what's the value of what I'm delivering in this practice to that player? And when you kind of look through those lenses, you can find stuff that's actually, on one hand, demotivating because you realize actually that I've been doing this for years and it's not very good. But that's such a euphoria moment as well, because you've just taken a massive step towards doing it better. And I will make a statement here, Aston, that there could be pushback from some listeners, and there has been pushback from other people I've discussed this with, and I'm absolutely fine with that because I respect everybody's thoughts, and that's the unique, beautiful thing of coaching. There's many different ways to do it, but I'm going to say this. Anytime we walk in a gym, we as coaches, we are not the experts in that facility. And I think when you look through the lens of, I've got to build learning from the experience of these players in front of me, then you're going a long way towards helping them to fulfill their potential. So for example, we talk a lot about creativity and enhancing decision-making. But how can I prescribe a player to develop his creativity? I can facilitate the environment that allows him to explore things, and he brings his own level of creativity to life. But I can't tell a player that this is what you're going to do to help you make you creative, as in prescribe the technique, the action. Now, I'm not talking about we don't teach. Of course we're teaching. It's not a case of rolling the ball out and letting them play. But I do think we have to have a mindset that we're not the experts in that room. We're not the experts in that gym. The players in front of us, we've got to build on the experiences they've previously had and facilitate an environment where they can continue to explore, continue to experiment, and then allow them to flourish as opposed to being very, very directive. And I want to say on this topic, Ashton, I want to be very clear. I know coaches, if you walk into one of my practices, you will see that I am in charge of that environment. It's not a case of, and I think this is where, you know, this athlete-centered approach to coaching, or what I like to term it right now is a need-centered approach. It's not as fluffy as it sounds. It's actually very difficult. And I want to be crystal clear. The coach is in charge, but there is an independent, there's a big element of interdependency on each other to grow and develop and facilitating that. So ultimately, what are we trying to do? And Ashton, please jump in and stop me at any point if you want, or otherwise I'll just end up waffling on. But if you peel it back to its fundamental source, what's my goal? What am I trying to achieve with the way I coach? I'm trying to develop players, and I'm going to go get a little bit academic here, so I apologize. It's not massively academic because I'm not very academic at all. But I want to develop a player who, when you unpick its definition, what is it? I want to develop a self-regulated learning athlete. So what does that mean? It means I want to develop athletes who are independent and self-motivated, and independent and self-motivated with acquiring knowledge and with acquiring skills. So what do they have to do in order to do that? Well, they've got to display initiative. They've got to display perseverance. They've got to display an ability to adapt to current situations. So it could be as simple as, let's really bring this to life now. Line drive, right down the gut, help defender rotates over. What do they adapt and do? What are they able to self-manage, be self-sufficient on making an effective decision? Kick pass, euro step, jump stop, whatever is effective for that player, can they adapt to that very moment? You know, and this process takes a lot of planning, monitoring, and evaluating by the player, not just by the coach. I mean, when we talk about planning, monitoring, and evaluating, we always pinpoint that to be coaches. I'm trying to help my players to plan, monitor, and evaluate so they can adapt themselves. And again, if I just put something on the end of that, why do it that way? So we should be asking the question, well, you're talking about the coach is in charge, but it's an interdependent approach. You're talking about you want to develop independent, self-motivated athletes who are self-motivated to acquire their own knowledge and skills. And you're talking about you want athletes who display initiative, perseverance, and adaptability. And somebody should ask, well, why do you want to do that? And for me, it's very simple. You want to start with the end in mind. If I got a player for 2 years, which we do in our academy, what do I want that player to look like at the end of those 2 years he leaves us or she leaves us? I want players who can adapt live under pressure when the game is on the line and they have the ball in their hands, or they have to defend somebody who has the ball in their hands, or they're running a lane. I want them to be able to think for themselves. I want them to be able to act under pressure, adapt live to the current situation. And in order to do that, we have to develop players to think for themselves. So there's a massive cognitive element in terms of this approach to coaching. And it's very much away from the prescribed actions. Now, there will come a point in time in the game, just to be very clear, and I'll end on this point, Ashton. There is a point in time, the uniqueness of this approach, it means it's a sliding scale. And I feel the master coach with this approach knows what button to press at the right time. So what buttons have you got to press? If the buttons you have to press is, when am I going to step in as a coach and take charge? When do I step away and let them solve it, let them problem solve? How long do I step away for? Because when I coach at the European Championship every summer, Ashton, I am stepping in a lot more to help them. Why? Because we haven't had a full season together. Because our time frame of preparation has been shorter. And the results in the European Championship at under 18, under 20 matter a lot more than they do with an under 14 club game. They matter a lot more than they do with an under 19 academy game as well, to be honest, in our country, in the UK. So that national team environment, the context can make this a sliding scale in terms of approach. It doesn't mean I'm going to go crazy on the sideline and be emotionally imbalanced and scream and shout at them when they get stuff wrong. It just means that I'm going to step in and help them with the solutions quicker. So there is a uniqueness to the approach, and I think understanding that sliding scale and knowing when to step in and when to step away and how long to step away for is the difference between somebody who's new on this journey or someone who's experienced on this journey.
Yeah, that's good. That's mastering knowing when to step in and when not to. Exactly. Kind of going more into that, you kind of just mentioned, could you speak on emotional intelligence? I kind of read a couple things that you worked on another podcast about EQ. So could you just go into more detail about that?
Yeah, I will do. And I guess the way the best way to do it, I reckon, is if I give you an example of what's important in our practices. And I guess what will come out of that is you'll see elements of developing emotional intelligence inside the practice. So let me start with something like scanning. So the term scanning, I'm hearing it more and more now. So it's clearly having some gravity with coaches. And what does scanning mean? And I'm talking scanning by the players as well as the coaches. So if I take myself, for example, when we have a practice session or during a game, there will be a lot of moments where I'm just standing back, not saying anything, and I'm scanning. But what am I scanning for? I'm scanning for what's the emotional state of the player. So in the moment, is the player emotionally balanced? Why? Because that will affect everything he or she does. But first of all, I've got to be emotionally balanced in order to scan effectively. So I'm trying to teach our players the same process. Now, the thing I like about this coaching process is I'm going to go on the same journey as the players. So away from the tech stuff, how I'm going to scan, I want the players to be scanning each other. How I communicate to the players, I want the players to communicate to each other and to the coaches the same way. And I'll talk about my thoughts and what effective communication are in a moment. But if we look at scanning helps us to make better decisions. Why? Number one, I said you have to be emotionally balanced, and calm is contagious. So it's not rocket science. You know, everybody knows you make better decisions when you're emotionally balanced than when you're fiery, red hot, and ready to explode. We know we make better decisions when we're emotionally balanced. So when I'm scanning on the sideline, the first thing I've talked about already, and I'll move on, I'm scanning, are the players emotionally balanced? Second thing I'll scan for, and remember, I want the players to do the same process. I will scan for the choices they're making, but also the execution of the choice. And I will scan both of those elements separately. So what choice did that player just make? And what was the execution of the choice? Now, before I scan for the execution, I'm taking on board, did that player truly fully commit to the choice they made? Because if you're not fully committing to the choice you make, then we should never, why would we review that choice? Why would we be even talking about what that player did technically, tactically? They gave a 50% effort. We don't survive with 50% efforts. We don't flourish and thrive with the effort of 50%. A full commitment, whether the outcome was poor or not, for us, success is this. And I tell the players all the time to give them a freedom of failure, which is linking to emotional intelligence, Ashton. And I'll really come back to that more succinctly in a minute. But if a player truly commits to a choice they make in the moment, and it ends up being the wrong choice, we still call that success. Because what I'm sharing with our guys, to remove the fear of consequence of getting things wrong, I'm saying to our guys all the time, success for us is you fully committing with full intent to the choice you make in the moment. And if you do that in every moment, we will be successful. So for example, if a player chooses to set a down screen instead of a back screen, but we wanted to set a back screen, if he fully commits to the back, to the down screen, I'll tell him, good job in terms of that was great commitment, but now let's review the choice you made. Next time I want that action to be a back screen, but great job. You fully committed to the choice you made. Now fulfill it, because we can't stop the game in mid-flow. So what I don't want is a player kind of hesitating. I'm not sure whether I should do this, whether I should that. Make your choice, fully commit to it. There's no fear of consequence if it's the wrong choice. It's only wrong if you don't fully commit. And that's got to come before everything else. We have to have emotional balance, and we have to have full intent, full commitment before we review any choice on tech tack or the outcome of the tech tack. So now, where does emotional intelligence come into this one? I'm asking the players to be true to themselves, like I'm asking my assistant coaches and like I'm asking myself. So we have to plan and progress for the needs of our true self, not what we think we are. So for example, if emotional intelligence for me and my assistant coaches is, this is who I am as a coach, whether I like it or not, I am at where I'm at. Because once you have an idea, and it's the same for the players, once you have an idea of your true self, where you're at on your journey, only then can you truly plan for your progression. Only then can you truly plan for what's my next stage of development. So we do a lot of self-reviewing stuff. And this is where we're linking it to emotional intelligence now. So if I'm doing a deep dive on myself, where I'm at, and I'm getting the players to do a deep dive on where they're truly at, then you're getting to understand yourself better. And then we share that with the entire group. Like, I'll tell the players, like, this is my weaknesses are X, Y, and Z. I'll tell the players that on the very first day we get together, the very first week we get together. You know, because I work in a small budget team, Ashton, we have a lot of new pro players every year. So I wear three hats as a coach. One is a semi-professional team where we have about 6 or 7 full-time pros. And then the rest of the team is made up of our talented academy players who are 18 to 19 years old and knocking on the door of national teams, all trying to get to the NCAA. So that's our pro team makeup. Then we've got our academy team, which is a team of those 18 and 19 year olds who are with us for 2 years and then trying to take the next step, whether it's national team or whether it's the States or they end up staying here in the UK. And then the third hat I wear is on the national team every summer. 18's last couple of years, under 20's this summer. And what we're trying to do really is get a deeper understanding of ourselves and each other. And once we have that understanding of each other, there has to be an acceptance with it. It's a bit like the communication. We have to acknowledge where we're at. We have to acknowledge where our teammates are at. We have to acknowledge where the coaches are at, and then accept that that's where we're at. So now when it's time to help each other and we put a facilitator in, like, you know, effective communication or the rule of three, which we can unpick in a moment, once there's acceptance that Ashton, you're at the level you're at and I'm at the level I'm at, I can't really ask you to do something or expect you to do something that you're not capable to do. That would be unfair of me as a coach, unfair of me as a teammate to put that pressure on you. So you have those elements. There's a big element of self-awareness and awareness of others. And now you're talking about the environment, which is the triangle of emotional intelligence we bring together. But I just want to say something about coaches from my perspective and where I was at on a journey. And I think I still fall into this trap sometimes, Ashton, but I'm aware of it so I can pull myself out of it quicker. Mm-hmm. I think coaches have what Stephen Rolnick calls a writing reflex too much. I'll say it again, a writing reflex. What does that mean? It means that we're trying to fix everything. You know, and as coaches, I feel we very often stand on that sideline, and some players too, actually. And we're almost becoming deficit detectors. We're just detecting all the bad stuff, you know, and we're trying to fix everything. And I think when you go down that road, you go down that journey, you take away the opportunity for the player to develop, number one, his or her self-awareness. You take away the opportunity for the player to practice. I want to emphasize the word practice because it does take practice. It's a skill in itself. You take away the opportunity for that player to practice self-managing. being self-sufficient, adjusting to what's going on in front of them, you're taking away the opportunity for that player to develop emotional intelligence, which can help them in other areas of their life. And I think as coaches, we go to that element too quick, too soon, the writing reflex, I'm going to fix it because I'm the head coach. Instead of standing back and giving them time to fix it themselves, but again, it goes back to the master coach, how long do you give them? That's knowing your players, obviously. But it's also being in control of your emotions as a coach, because when you're not in control of your emotions, we try to fix everything too quick, too soon. And Stephen Rolnick talks about this one a lot. Us as coaches need to wear the strength lenses a little bit more. What are we seeing that they're doing well? And just reinforce that as well. So I just wanted to mention the strength lenses while I was talking about being deficit detectors. But when you, what does it look like from the outside, Ashton? I think would be a good topic to discuss briefly. Yeah. I think when you're looking at an emotionally intelligent team, what would you see? And by all means, I can send you some video of our guys in action if you want to see it being brought to life. But by the way, just so people know, we get it wrong just as much as we get it right, because it's a long-winded process in order to help players and coaches and even myself, who I've been on this 8, 9, 10-year journey with this stuff now through the help of Mark Bennett. But this journey takes a long time for players and for coaches. But what does it look like? It basically looks like players communicating effectively to players, players communicating effectively to coaches, and I say players communicating to coaches, not just listening, talking also, and also coaches communicating effectively to players. And, you know, we summarize it like this. It's very simple. What does effective communication look like? I don't believe it's what I used to say before. What I used to say before was ELC. We've all heard that one before, early, loud, continuous, or early, loud, and I forget what some people call the other C, but that to me is not effective communication. That can be, but it can also be just noise in the gym. Effective communication for us is this. When somebody says something to you, it has specificity in terms of what it was, but it also has a desired outcome. So for example, if we're communicating live during a game, then my job, we've put a thing in place called the 3 A's. I have to acknowledge that somebody said something to me, and I'm talking about live play now, not during a timeout, not during a pregame. I'm talking about live play, running back on defense, you know, playing off ball defense, running in transition. If somebody says something, it's a thumbs up. We acknowledge that we heard somebody say something. And I think when you watch our games, you'll see our guys give the thumb up over to me a lot when I say something. Now, what that means is they've accepted what you've said. It doesn't mean they've accepted. It means they've heard it. And then what we want people to do is, regardless of what they said to you, whether it was an emotional response or whether it was something that you disagree with, we want you to accept what they said. Now, acting on it will come down to the fact whether you believe in that or not. So if a teammate says something to a teammate, then we expect them to act on it. And act on it could be in two ways. One, you do what that player said because of that, it's adding value to us. Or two, you disagree with it, but you deal with that in the stoppage of play. So you will acknowledge and accept it, but you're not necessarily going to act on it. And when you see that being brought to life, that's a great, for us, a good measurement of you asked me to talk about emotional intelligence and the importance. That gives us an idea that gives us a picture of an element of emotional intelligence, let's say. Sorry for the long-winded answer, Ashton. I felt like I've gone on for ages there.
No, that was incredible. I have a couple pages of notes, but kind of going, you know, you said thumbs up during the game, you know, that might not mean they agree, but, you know, they've heard you and are listening to you. But what does effective communication look like in the team timeouts, in the huddle, in the halftime speech, you know, before the game? What do those things look like in those situations?
So from a practical basis, and I'm not always getting this one right, but from a practical basis, once we come into a timeout, and really timeouts go so quick, don't they? I mean, as I look back on myself, I'm lucky, Ashton, that I've been recording my timeouts for about 4 years, you know, maybe a couple from 5 years ago. So at any point in time, like, I'll tell you what I do. Every Monday morning, I get into the office, I watch my timeouts, and I watch my pregame and halftime and postgame interaction with the players. It takes about 15 to 20 minutes. And I watch them every Monday morning so I can learn what it is. I put my deficit detectors on, actually, and I look at is what are the things that weren't good from my behalf, or where were the players at in those moments? Like, how were they responding to each other? How were they responding to me? What was the information? And technical, tactical as well, because it's a really important factor of it. I don't want to be dismissive of the tech, but we haven't really talked about that. But I will look at all those different elements and I'll say, right, what was effective, what was ineffective? And that's me being honest with myself for my own growth. So I will look back on those videos. Now, when I go into the timeouts, what I like to do is give the players, you know, 10 seconds to even 20 seconds. Sometimes it becomes majority of the timeout where they're having interactions with themselves. You know, sometimes it's emotional response and then we have to step in. I mean, I'm stepping in straight away, taking complete control of that when it is an emotional response because it's not adding value. Now, because of where I'm at in my coaching, it looks different in different times. Very often I'm in control of my emotions, but sometimes I'm not, because that's the nature of a human being and where I'm at. But in those timeouts, I always ask the players, okay, first thing, guys, why did I call the timeout? Straight away, it gets them engaged. It gets them talking and it gets them thinking. What I don't want is players coming to the timeout, sitting down, just completely like disengaging with what's going on and what we're about to discuss. And you know, using it really to cognitively rest. And I've had this conversation a few times with other coaches. I think sometimes we have to call a timeout and we should call a timeout just to let them rest, just to let their minds rest, just to let them, we let them physically rest a lot in the game. But how often do we let their minds rest? And again, you're back to the master coach of knowing when is the right time to allow that player to cognitively switch off because he needs it. His cup is full. So in the timeouts, practically, it looks like me asking the players, why did I call a timeout, or why did the opposition coach call a timeout? Straight away, they're engaging. Then I will give my inputs, one or two key points, that's it. And before we get out of timeout, I try to remember and say to them, right, guys, remind me real quick right now, what am I going to see when you go on the floor? Just so they're very clear that actually when they go on the floor, yeah, coach, we're in a 2-3 zone on the two side pass. We're matching up man to man. We're not worrying about mismatches. It's closest guy. Okay, great, guys, go and show me. That way, I've just checked in the space of 5 seconds less, I've just checked if they've understood what we've talked about in that timeout or if they were listening. Because I don't want them going back on the floor, having been in that timeout and there's been no value. Halftime is a similar process, but it's a bit longer. Another way we get the players to really input and kind of engage them is we do a WhatsApp process of review after the game where, you know, and this is not for every coach and I'm cool with that. You know, I've had many dialogues with many coaches who don't believe in this system and they believe that the coach, you know, and I'm giving the player too much of a voice, and I'm okay with that. I understand that side of things, but for where I'm at as a coach right now, I believe in this principle, this philosophy, but I like to give the players a voice. I want to know what's going on in their head. I want it to be real. Let's not hide and pretend things are great. Let's get it all out and open and talk about it. And then let's move on. Let's adapt and move on and adjust and tweak what we need to tweak. And it allows me to spend one-to-one time with the players to unpick some of the stuff they said. So I mentioned the WhatsApp review process. After every game, you know, within the hour, we finish, we leave the gym. Within the hour, players know that they got to send in their review. And all the coaches and players are on this WhatsApp group. So what does it look like? Players first, coaches last. So no coach. No, I'm lucky to have two assistant coaches in the academy and in the men's team. They've got to go second last. I've got to go last with my review. All players go before us. So what do they review? They review three elements. Number one, their own performance. And I'm talking about two or three bullet points per category here, Ashton. I'm not talking about essay type answers. It can be as long as the player wants it to be, but it very often ends up at like two or three or four bullet points. So they review their own performance first. They review the team's performance second. And this is what a lot of coaches have pushed back on me with, which is fine, like I said a while ago. They also review my and the assistant coach's performance. And then we get to the same process. The coaches go through the same process. They review their own performance first, assistant coaches do and I do. Then we review the player's performance, and then we review each other's performance. So I would review the assistants would review me. Now, what happens early on in this process, for anybody listening, if you try this, here's what's going to happen. Here's exactly what's going to happen. For the first few weeks or months, or until you deal with it, the players are going to be completely compliant and say what they think you want them to say. Why? Because you're a supreme being to the player in their eyes, especially junior players. Or especially players on contract. you know, players who are depending on minutes. So we get to the point every year after about a month or two where I sit them down and say, guys, your reviews are just not honest and they're not what reality is. And I have to re-explain to them, which is absolutely fine. And I understand why. I have to re-explain to them the value of them being honest. And there's no need to have a fear of consequence. Nobody's going to play less minutes because you said I coached a bad game. Nobody's going to get dropped just because you said, you know, you had a good performance, but your teammates didn't commit to their choices as well as they should have done. No one's going to get dropped because head coach didn't give support timeout down the stretch. So I will always be very honest with my review. And what you'll find early on is like, I review mine and I would grade it a 5 out of 10, where they're grading it a 9 and 10 out of 10 or whatever. We don't use a grading system, but just to be more succinct. And once you get past that process, Ashton, once you get past that barrier, that little bump in the road, once you smoothen that over, the reviews that come back from the players carry significant value, but they carry value for what you need to manage one-to-one with them, what's going on in their heads. It also manages their interactions with each other, because sometimes they'll say something about each other that might rub somebody up the wrong way and create a bit of hostility, and we deal with it. We don't hide it. We get it out in the open. And also, it allows me to plan better for the following week, because they express what they're feeling from that game, their performance. It just highlights to me that we're not as good at defending off-ball screens as I thought we were. Not just my eye test, but actually what they're saying about it shows me. So it's a great way to baseline and assess different components, different elements.
Yeah, that's really good. When players are honest and open, seeing like the transformation that you're talking about is incredible. What has been your approach? Obviously, you have a great approach to your team and the individuals and your players, but what's been your approach when it comes to your personal growth as a person and as a coach?
Oh, I wish I'd have known this when I was younger. You know, I wish I'd have done this earlier. And what I wish I had done was share my thoughts, feelings, and reflections. You know, now that I'm a bit more experienced, and, you know, I guess when you take on a national team coach's job, you expose yourself to being critiqued because the country is watching you perform at the European Championship, and, you know, results matters to everybody, including the funding sources. So you take a bit of a batter and a bruise, and you survive that process. And what comes with that is confidence. Well, two things, I guess. But for me, what came with that was, you know, confidence and belief in what I'm doing. Like, I will always back myself, Ashton. I've had enough punches thrown at me, let's say, for the want of a better phrase, and not stay down, that I've built myself strong enough to believe in what I'm doing. And, you know, what I wish I had done, and what I do now a lot is share. So I'm sharing a lot of stuff with you that may sound wishy-washy and may sound cosmetic to a lot of coaches. And I'm all right with that. I'm absolutely all right with that. But I wouldn't have been 10 years ago. I wouldn't have been 10 or 12 years ago. So 10 or 12 years ago, or even 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and even now I'm taking a lot of notes and I'm learning and asking loads of questions. But what I'm doing that's carrying a lot of value for me right now is I'm sharing my thoughts, my philosophies, my concepts, my reflections. And I'm asking people with authenticity, and I'm being genuinely curious about what their thoughts are on my philosophy of coaching. Now, two things are happening, and it's carrying a lot of value for me. Number one, when I share something with somebody, like this WhatsApp review process, when I share that with somebody, two things generally happen. Somebody either says, yeah, that's really, really, like a group of people will come back and say, oh, that's really good. I really like that. I'm going to try that. Or actually, that's really good. But if you added this element to it, it'd be even better. So that means it's coming back to me stronger than I gave it out, because they're giving me another idea to add to it. So sharing that reflection has actually added to that process that now I can use. Or the other thing that generally happens, a group of people will come back and say, well, actually, I don't believe in that process. It's not very good. And here is why. Now it gives me a different angle to consider. So now I go away and make a judgment. Actually, I think that group of people are right. This process isn't very good, actually, because if you unpick it the way they did, what they're saying makes a lot of sense. So I wish I had shared more. And I think that's one of the things I'm doing now that's helping me to really understand why I'm doing what I'm doing and really understand the value of what I'm doing. And I don't think we do that enough as coaches. I think quarantine has been amazing in one way, because coaches have been like what Lee Klein and Layson Perkins and these, and you guys as well, like what you lot are doing with this online platform to share, you know, coaching philosophies, concepts, tech, you know, physical development, you know, mental development, mental skills approach. Like what you guys are all sharing on this platform has been fantastic, because it's allowed all of us to go away and consider things that we may not have heard before. So for me, the sharing element is probably the biggest growth I've had, alongside just really, really informal discussions with coaches, just connecting with coaches. I'll share one more thing, Ashton. I'm giving you really long-winded answers, so I need to apologize.
Oh, it's great.
But I'll tell you one of the better things I've done in the past 2 years, and I did a presentation for Layson and Leon at Virtual Coaches Clinic about it, is I titled it 2 years of Zoom calling. So I know Zoom has taken off here during quarantine or whatever, but I've been using it for about 2 years. And what I was using it for, I remember saying to my national team assistant coaches about 2 years ago, I said, guys, look, there's not a lot of clinics going on around the country. You know, our CPD is limited. You know, you can watch a lot of YouTube clinics from FIBA and beyond, and Coaching You Live and all that really, really great stuff. But I said, what we're not getting with that stuff is the ability to ask questions and go deeper on topics. So I said to my three assistant coaches that were in the national team at that time, I said, guys, I'm going to start reaching out to random coaches all over the world. I'm going to contact them on LinkedIn, Twitter, private message, and just ask them, can we have 45 minutes of your time on a Zoom call? And I've done that now, Ashton, for 2 years, and probably connected with more than 100 coaches. And as recent as yesterday morning, like our last one was with Peter Lonergan, who's the head of performance for Basketball Australia. You know, and the day before was actually had Layson on there, and we've got Joe Montagna from Blair Academy coming up on Friday, and Joe Prunty, who's, you know, done his time in the NBA a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, different people like Bill Bezic, who was a world-renowned sports psychologist, having worked with Manchester United for a long time, and just Hannah Matola from Finland. I could go on and on and on and on and on. And what we've done is, and what's come out of this is, not one call has been 45 minutes. They've been an hour and a half minimum, and it's allowed us to take a really deep dive into specific topics. I remember having Vladan Draskovic on for 90 minutes talking about on-ball defense only, you know, and it's been absolutely fascinating and a wonderful journey to go on. And I remember saying this to Layson the other day, we were talking about his virtual coaching clinics. I remember saying to him the other day, what I've learned so much content and knowledge from this Zoom experience for 2 years. But what really struck me the most was how giving coaches are, how giving people in performance are. We had Fran Fraschilla on one about a month ago, and that was just awesome. None of these clinics, Ashton, are to go online. I wasn't doing it to put it online. I wasn't doing it to create a platform. I was just doing it for my own professional development. And I offered my three assistant coaches if they want to come along the journey. And it's been by far probably one of the most beneficial things we've done, and it's very, very informal. So during quarantine, and last point I'll make on this, during quarantine, I said to our federation, look, I'm going to continue with these Zoom calls. If you'd like me to open them up to domestic coaches here in the UK, I'm more than happy. I will continue with the same process I've been doing, but I'm happy to have any domestic coach here in this country just sit in the background on the Zoom call and just listen to the conversations we're having if you want. And we've had up to like, there's about 120 people in that WhatsApp group. I just created a hot seat notification group for WhatsApp on WhatsApp for when we're doing it. And you get anything up to 60 coaches just listening in. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful 2 years of learning for me, Ashton. And it hasn't cost me a penny. And I'm doing it from the living room in my house. I'm doing it from London, you know, and it's just been absolutely wonderful.
No, that's really good. I think it's so important for us to come together as educators and coaches and people in the basketball community to learn and grow from each other. So that's really, really good. You're dropping major nuggets this morning. But just in wrapping up, what are some golden nuggets of advice that you want to share to those who are aspiring to coach one day or
are currently coaching that want to continue to get better?
Well, I think I've touched off one. Just reach out to people. People are giving. People want to give. Reach out to those who are better than you or who work on a level that you don't work on and just get an understanding of it. You know, collectively, not just the tech tack. You know, there's some great strength and conditioning coaches out there. Actually, Ashton, one of the best Zoom calls we had was with a physiotherapist. He was amazing. We did like 90 minutes on sleep and wellness and, you know, wellness being like the true foundation of performance, because if you don't take care of the wellness element, then how can you perform that jump hook? How can you perform great on ball defense if you're not taking care of that side of things? So it would be surround yourself with good people, people who are not deficit detectors, people who are more interested in progressive growth than politics, for example. The other things I would say is share. Like I urge coaches, and particularly here in the UK, because we have so many coaches to learn from, we just got to be brave enough to share and put what we believe out there and not worry about how it comes back or not worry what tumble dryer it goes through. It doesn't matter. Just put it out there for sharing and let's help each other. I think that's one of the biggest things, like I said to you a while ago, I wish I had done better. And there was one more point I will make is, if it comes back to me now, is yeah, coach, this is the other one. Last point I'll make for any coaches out there who want to go on a journey of progressive learning and development. Just be honest, but honest with what? Honest with yourself, like where you're at as a coach. And again, that comes back to being, you know, open to being vulnerable. Vulnerability is a wonderful, wonderful tool for growth and tool for development. Like I talked about, share the reflections and not worry about what comes back. It very often it'll come back with more with value added, and it'll even be better than when before you shared it. But the other thing is speak to the players. And this is the last point I'll make, Ashton. I've never learned more than speaking to players I've coached and players I haven't coached. Like, you know, some of these Zoom calls I'm having, Kieran Achara, who's a Scottish man who's now retired, played in the Olympics for GB in 2012, you know, played 4 years in the States, played around Europe in top leagues. He's 39 years old right now, and having come out of the game and having had different coaching styles and having had different teammates in different worlds, different style of game, like unpicking his experiences was so beneficial, really beneficial. And currently with Stephen Rolnick, we're going through a process where we've got three players on a Zoom call, and we're going into session three very soon next week, actually, about their experiences from other coaches. And what do they look for in other coaches? You know, asking a player, what do you want from the ideal coach? You know, you do that and you will be so surprised at to what they will say. And if we've got time, which will take me about 30 seconds, Ashton, I'll share with you a little project I did on that.
Yes. So
I had to do a presentation for the Federation about 2 years ago, Great Britain Federation, Basketball England Federation. And they asked me to choose a topic. So the topic was wide open. And I thought to myself, right, well, if I go up there and talk about ball screen defense or transition offense, you know, it's all stuff they've probably heard before. So I thought, let me just kind of go down a less traditional coaching clinic route. And I thought, and I titled it like rethinking some traditional coaching ideas. And so I reached out to a bunch of players, like from different ages, stages, different career paths. Some were retired. Some were playing currently pro in Spain, pro in Italy. All had been through the GB setup, you know, national team at some point in time in their careers. And a group of them who've been very successful and some have had their struggles. And I asked them simply this. I contacted them all by WhatsApp and I said, can you just send me back like a 30-second to 1 minute video with your gut instinct response to this question? And the question was very simple. What do you look for in the ideal coach? And what came back from those guys, I'll just list you a couple of the common threads as they commonalities as they come into play. They said stuff like, they're looking for honest coaches who trust their players. They're looking for coaches who allow their players to problem solve. But they're also looking for coaches who take charge when they need. So actually, it's very much based around how I want to coach and some of the stuff I spoke to you already about. They also said they're looking for coaches who are willing to step back and willing to accept ideas from the players. And a very important point that most of those guys made, like these are just commonalities, most of them said they want a coach who's willing to invest time in them as a person and not just an athlete. But they're also looking for coaches who are going to be patient, who are going to be patient in difficult moments and not be emotional when there's pressure in going in the game. And I asked one player, a retired player, I said, unpick that one for me a bit more. He said, Alan, listen, he said, when I was playing and the coach and the game was on the line down the stretch and the coach was getting emotional, it led me to be a bit emotional. It led me to be uncertain. But he said, I've also played for coaches. Now, he played at a very high level. He said, Alan, I've also played for coaches who were very calm down the stretch in a close game. And he said, that was contagious. You know, you look at the, what's his name? Bennett. NCAA coach. Calm is contagious was one of the things he said a couple of years back. Tony Bennett.
Yes.
Calm is contagious. And what a wonderful saying. And that's what that player was saying to me. So they're looking for coaches who are calm under pressure when the game matters most, because that's infectious. And the last few things they said, they want coaches who will help them grow as people. And that goes back to investing time in a person. But this final point I'll make, I love. One of the players who's played NCAA 4 years and played a pro league as well, so he's had a lot of experiences. He said, Alan, if I could go back and do it again, I would want to play for a coach who I know has a desire to grow and a desire to evolve and will grow with the players. He said, I would love to play for a coach who doesn't pretend like he knows it all. So basically they're talking about playing for a coach who's comfortable with vulnerability, but also in charge. You know, this is not an equal opportunity situation at the end of the day. The coach has a job to do. The players have a job to do. But it's breaking down that ego barrier or that dictatorship, let's say. So there were some things that the players shared. And to go back to your question, to link that back to your question, I think that would be wonderful if coaches asked players more often, what do you look for in a coach? I think it could really shape a couple of things.
No, that's really good advice. Thank you. For those that want to reach out further to maybe have more questions or just to learn more about you, what's the best way to contact you, coach?
Probably the best ways. I'm not a big social media guy except for Twitter. You know, I don't use Instagram, Facebook rarely, but Twitter @coachkeen14. I jump on there every day. I follow some wonderful, wonderful people, both here in the UK and abroad, who I'm stealing from every day. So I check Twitter very frequently. It's probably the best way. And if we want to go further from there, we can jump on a phone call after that process.
Perfect. Just want to say thank you again for getting on. Really thoroughly enjoyed your insight and your perspective. So thank you so much for taking some time.
It was my pleasure, and great job with you guys as well. I love following what you guys do on social media, so thank you also.
Thank you. Have a great week. See you next time.
You too.